Hi, I'm Willie Miller.
Hi, I'm Seb Coe.
I'm Peter Beckham.
Hello, I'm Jonathan Mackey.
Hi, it's Grant Hackett here.
Hi, I'm Sharon Spoon from the Wallaroo.
I'm Azuma Nelson.
I'm Gashirin, and you're listening to Not the Footish.
Yes, you are indeed listening to another podcast of Not the Footy Show. And as usual, we've got a couple of topics to discuss. Some of them may be a little bit hotter than others. And we've also got one special guest. And our guest this time is Ragnar Purje, who has a PhD in cognitive neuroscience. Now, you may wonder why we're going to be talking to him, but he helped get Johnny Famichon, the boxer, back on his feet and talking again after he was hit by a car. And also I met him at the unveiling of the Johnny Famichon statue, and I found him a very interesting man, and I just wondered how much we're brain fit when we play sport as opposed to being physically fit. So we're going to explore that when we chat to Ragnar later in the podcast. But I'm Ashley Morrison.
And I'm John Lee. I'm looking forward to that interview too. It's very, very interesting subject to talk about.
It is. We could have talked for a lot longer, but obviously we're on a limited time frame here, and hopefully if anyone wants more information they can contact us anyway, and we'll put you in touch with Ragnar. But John, I believe you're starting us off this show.
Well, I am, Ashley. I'm not exactly sure how happy you'll be with this subject, because it's a sport we don't talk about on this
program. As long as you keep referring to it as that, that'll be good.
Well, with my tongue firmly placed within my cheek, like to congratulate the sport we don't talk about for inventing women's sport in the 21st century.
Oh, it is incredible. You would think that it had never existed before.
You would.
And the way the media have just suddenly latched onto it.
Mate, choo 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 comes the gravy train, and didn't they just jump on that?
It's just incredible, isn't it? I have to agree with you. You would think that women had never played sport.
You would.
Or any other sport ever before in their lives.
And that Australia had no elite sportswomen before this point in time.
Marjorie Jackson, who was she?
Oh, Shirley Strickland, don't know. Dawn Fraser, some name.
Margaret Court?
Yeah.
Did she play Ludo or
Elspeth
something?
Elspeth Clements? Gee, she could play hockey a little bit. There's a whole pile of them. We could go through the amount of elite Australian women's sportswomen there've been over the last 150 years, and it would be an exhaustive list. And that's right. That's how long Australian rules football has had to realise that women. The sport we don't mention has had to realise that not only do women play sport, but actually they were playing their sport as well. Women's football did actually exist before 2 years ago when the AFL decided to throw buckets of money at it.
But I believe that they're not throwing as much money as they would like us to believe. My understanding is the government has thrown the money at it.
Oh, look, they saw those grants that were being handed out to other sports and thought, we want a piece of that, and concocted this sport, season, league, whatever you want to call it.
A month.
That's elite to me. When I think of elite sports people, I think of people that train for a couple of months and play a 6 to 10 week season. That says elite. And you know what? Having said that, I feel bad about saying that, because the girls that are involved take it very seriously. And good luck to them. I am not against women playing any sort of football. If you want to, you go for it. What is irritating me so much is the lack of respect that's been shown to every other sport that has provided elite women's programs for a very, very, very long time, and suddenly have been swamped by this idea that's been sold to the general public that, oh, this is the bright new dawn for women's sport. And it's just rubbish.
The thing that I think sticks in my craw a little bit is exactly what you're saying, but also the fact that if you look at it, and we've seen women wanting parity in terms of payment with men's sport over the years. But surely in this instance, women's sport like netball, women's hockey, women's cricket should be saying, we want parity in the coverage you in the media are giving women's, the sport we don't mention. Because it is ridiculous. I mean, there was a whole page in the rag that is the West Australian. And yet, you know, when was the last time you saw netball, hockey, women's cricket given a whole page? I can't remember a women's sport being given a whole page in the West Australian.
Yeah, maybe tennis. That's Australian Open time of the year. But it's interesting that all of these sports have been able to get by and still produce elite quality athletes and do it without all of the fanfare that has gone on with the AFLW. And quite frankly, it's not an elite competition, mate. It's not even an elite football competition. And maybe it'll get better. I'm sure it will. Blah, blah. All those sorts of arguments about it. But let's not kid ourselves about where it's at right now and the over-the-blown hype that has come along with it. Now, we got 40,000 odd people there the other night at the stadium to a game where essentially was free. They called it at a ticketed event. People were asked to make a gold coin donation, how much money they raised.
That's not a ticketed event, I'm sorry.
It's not. I get what you're saying. Who paid for the public transport that was free? When can I have my ticket to the hockey? Is our Premier going to come around and provide an Uber for me to get to my next hockey game I want to go and see? Now, if you're building public transport into the ticket price, as they do with rugby and all the other sports that go on there, that's fine. Do it that way. But don't just give out large wads of money because people want to go to a sporting event that's free. I mean, you know, I want to go to sporting events as well. Pay for me to go to them.
I think there's another point as well that if you look at this, and again, if the government is going to give funding and whatever, and let's be fair, we have that code of football is unique to Australia. Okay, they're trying to take it to other outposts around the world. It's unique to Australia. Like gridiron is unique to America.
Pretty much.
Pretty much, yeah. But it is called that because it is a national game. And there's nothing wrong with it, and I think it's great. It's a tourist attraction. It's a great, unique sport in this country. But if you're going to throw money at things, you should be throwing it at the sports where we have an international presence, where we can promote the country, we can promote our athletes, we can win medals, we can win World Cups, we can win, you know, on an international stage. And we, because that's what the average kid wants to see. They want to see their athletes competing against the best in the world. Because that's what inspired me as a child, was seeing an Ashes test match, seeing England take on the West Indies and the might of those fast bowlers, you know, without helmets in those days, showing my age. But also, when the Olympics came around, seeing the likes of Alan Wells running against the Jamaicans and all the sprinters from the Eastern Bloc, those were the things that inspired you, was like, wow, a little guy from Scotland can take on all these guys, you know, from massive, massive countries and can beat them. Those were the inspirational stories. And I just think if we're going to put money in these things, we've seen how much money the AFL has in its bank. It doesn't need government support, in my opinion.
Not when there it spends $300 million setting up two new teams.
Yeah, and you look at, John, and you look at the sports in this country where people have struggled to even get there. I mean, the one I always remember was the aerobic guy, Kieran.
Oh, yeah.
And I've forgotten his surname, has slipped my mind. But, you know, here was the guy that paid for himself to compete in the World Aerobics Championships, won the World Championship, but had to fly himself and his coach around the world and got no funding.
Look at the Australian indoor hockey teams that competed at the Indoor Hockey
World
Cup.
Yeah, they had to do crowdfunding.
Which we've heard nothing about in the local media. We've heard all about, you know, girls who can kick 30 metres, but we've heard nothing about what's gone on over in Berlin. And just by the way, in case you hadn't heard, in the men, oh, I can't remember what the women
men,
came.
Men
the
lost men 4-0 to Iran in the bronze medal.
In the bronze medal playoff. But whichever team won that game was going to become the first side outside of Europe to win a medal at a World Indoor Championship. That's a phenomenal effort from a bunch of blokes that paid their way to get there. Now, the women got there as well. They didn't quite have the results they would have liked, but they still made the top 16 in the world and paid for it all themselves.
And, I mean, actually, that raises another point. For Iran to win the bronze medal, phenomenal
Brilliant effort. Brilliant.
You know, I mean, here was a country that, to be fair, they go, look, we're going to struggle at 11-a-side, but we're going to focus our attention on indoor 5-a-side. And if you think makes a lot of sense where they are, they've now won a bronze medal at a World Cup. Phenomenal achievement. And that is only going to grow the game. That is going to be inspirational, I would think, to hundreds, maybe thousands of Iranians.
Absolutely brilliant. It was, as much as I didn't like to see Australia lose.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm glad it was Iran and not Germany or England.
Yeah, not an established nation.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, there was almost the bit of the fairy tale about the whole thing.
There is. Now, you mentioned pay parity and that sort of thing between men and women's sport. Do you know, is there a difference in pay between being a member of the Australian men's hockey team or the Australian women's hockey team? Do you know?
I don't know. I tend to steer away from those sort of things if I can avoid it.
I would like to think, I'm sure, well, I would imagine AIS, they get paid the same, that there wouldn't be a disparity because the federal government wouldn't pay men and women differently for doing the same thing. I mean, there's all sorts of legislation
but
about that.
But of course, the scholarship's changed. If you think, remember with the AIS, it used to be that it was an individual athlete scholarship. Yeah. Then what they did was they gave the money to the sport, and the sport then divvied out the money to the various athletes.
Yeah, I'm hoping there would be something in there that says, if we're giving you this, it's got to be, you know, you're not paying the men more than you're going to pay the women.
Well, you would think not, because they play in hockey, they play pretty much the same amount of international tournaments.
Oh, they train the same, they do the same things. So, you know, I wouldn't imagine there'd be any difference in pay. And I wonder how that goes with other Olympic sports that get a lot of money through their Olympic, you know, just swimmers, for instance. I'm not sure how swimmers get paid through being a swimmer by the AIS or by the Sports Commission or whoever. Oh, boom, boom. That's very good from you. That's very good. But, you know, I can't imagine that a male swimmer gets paid more than a female swimmer for the training aspect and those sorts of things of their sport. Now, I know that athletes get medal bonuses if they achieve certain levels, and I wouldn't imagine a medal bonus is any different for being a man or a woman either. It's just 8,000 or 10,000 or whatever the amount is. Win a gold medal. Doesn't matter.
I do believe, though, I think with the hockey, that if you live in Perth at the AIS, you get more than if you are a remote member of the squad. So, for example, if, like, Mark Knowles has now moved back to Queensland, I believe that he is not getting as much as he would have done if he was here, part of the program full time, in that he's training there on his own. He gets slightly less,
but they pay for him to fly over here for camps and stuff when necessary.
I presume that would be why they're getting less, because they have to pay that.
It's just interesting because, you know, we talk about parity between men and women in pay in sport. The fact of the matter is that eyes on sets and bums on seats pay sportsmen's wages, professional sports wages. Now, have you tuned into a women's A-League game on SBS at all?
A W League, you mean?
W League,
I have watched the W League, yeah.
And how many times have you seen an empty Etihad Stadium? How many times have you seen an empty Brisbane Stadium or an empty NIB Stadium or an empty any whatever stadium you want to talk about? I don't know what their ratings are like, but considering how diabolical they are for the A-League, I can't...
Hey, look,
the women's A-League would be better.
The A-League can see empty stadiums.
Yeah, but...
Or stadia, rather.
But that's a big point that women's sport's gotta come to terms with, that you can't just scream for parity because you happen to be a woman. You've gotta scream for parity because you're providing the same entertainment value to the broadcaster.
I think the same thing applies, John.
And that's male or female, any sport.
You have to offer quality as an athlete, and you have to be marketed properly.
Yeah.
And if we look, it's down to the administrators to market it, and it's down to the athletes to provide the quality.
And I will say that no sports person gets paid to train. They get paid to perform on match day. Okay, so forget about all this argument about how much and hard you train. You should get a certain level of remuneration. No. It's on what you do on performance day that gets people watching you.
I don't know if you've seen in the UK now, there's a big push because obviously what's happening, you know, is a lot of the big clubs are trying to sign young teenagers very, very early so that they've got them locked in, and then they're offering them when they turn 17 is when they can turn professional. And so some of these players are being, you know, signed at £20,000 a week at 17. And Arsene Wenger, and in fact Steven Gerrard has come out, and they're two of the really big vocal people at the moment, are saying, no, what we should say is you can only pay 17-year-olds this across the board, or there is a ceiling at which they cannot be paid more wages. He goes, until they've proven themselves. He goes, it is ridiculous that we are paying players on the promise of them being successful these vast amounts of money. And it's giving them a false sense of security. It's killing some of them because of the expectation that they've had all this money lumped on them. They've now got to perform. And he goes, it's a disservice to everyone, to the game, to the club, to the player. And I think that's a really, really smart move. And I would actually like to see that come in, and hopefully it will down the track, where there is either a ceiling or there is a maximum wage, or you can only pay this much to players of 17 and maybe say 18.
I think one of the problems with having a salary cap is clubs feel the need to spend that cap, and in very a lot of sports you've got to spend a minimum anyway.
I'm not saying a salary cap for the club. I'm just saying for the teenagers coming through.
Well, the point I'm getting at is that salary caps encourage overpayment to players.
Yeah.
If
or they, a way to circumnavigate.
Yeah. So what? When if you take things back to a performance-based payment system, sure, you've got to give people a basic wage, so to speak, but then you know, pay on performance.
Oh, yeah. Look, I'm a big fan of that. I've always thought that the way it should work is, you know, if you've got an experienced player, you pay him, let's be hypothetical, we pay, you know, if it was in a state league competition like the hockey or the football here, you go, okay, you're an experienced player, John, you've been with the side for 7-8 years, you're getting $300 a game, a young buck coming up is getting 50, but his win bonus will be 100, or sorry, and then the experienced player gets a higher win bonus, or gets a lesser win bonus, you know, whatever, but what I think, you know, my idea was to give the experienced player slightly less but a higher win bonus, so that he then encourages the younger players to perform, because that's what you need, is the older players to pull the young ones up. And so if he gets a bigger win bonus if they win, he's going to encourage the younger players to perform.
Yeah. And you know
it's
what?
It's a difficult one.
It is, because any idea we come up with that we think is a solution, as soon as you implement it, will immediately the holes will become apparent. And when you're doing this sort of thing and deciding on those issues, you've got to be aware that there are going to be problems that you do not foresee. And if you're ready for problems that you can't foresee, then you should be able to cope with it.
Oh, and I mean, I remember when I first came over here playing cricket, there was a player, you know, was getting paid per run after he'd scored his first 100 runs. And I have never played with a more selfish cricketer in my entire life. In that he would bat for hours, score 70 or 80, and then we'd have to lose 3 wickets just throwing the bat, trying to get a decent score. And I was very vocal about that, and we almost came to blows one day after a game, because he almost cost us the game. You know, I think we won in the last over just because he batted so damn slowly, because all he was worried about was the money going in his wallet.
Gee, if the key to it's just batting slowly, I should have been paid $2.
Well, you know, he was just nerdling a run and over or something, you know?
That fast he was scoring. Gee, he's never seen me bat before. We should get on with it, shouldn't we?
Absolutely.
I'm Caitlin Bassett, and you're listening to Not the Footy Show.
You are indeed listening to Not the Footy Show, and we hope you're enjoying our thoughts on various topics in sport. But it's now time for us to turn our attention to our guest on this podcast, and as I mentioned, it is Ragnar Purje. Now, Ragnar has a PhD in cognitive neuroscience. Now, just to give you an idea, he used to drive from Geelong to Frankston every Saturday for a number of years to work with Johnny Famechon after he was hit by a car and was left paralysed and also had a stroke. Now, he not only had Johnny walking, but also had him running after several months of work. But most important of all, he had Johnny walk down the aisle when he married his wife, Glenys. And that was obviously a massive part in Johnny Famechon's life. Now, Ragnar wrote a thesis that was titled The Phenomenon of the Recovery of Johnny Famechon, A Discourse of Resilience and Brain Plasticity. I met Ragnar at the unveiling of the Johnny Famechon statue, where he also explained how he got Johnny back walking. And I just thought it was such a great story, and I was so interested in obviously the cognitive neuroscience side of things and whether we are actually, or our athletes are, brain fit as well as being physically fit. I asked him to join us on the show. Ragnar Purje, welcome to Not the Footy Show.
Nice to be here, Ashley. Thank you.
Well, obviously, as I mentioned there in the introduction, we were very fortunate to meet at the unveiling of the statue
for Johnny Famechon. And I'm thinking probably the best place to start is your involvement there with Johnny and how you actually helped him get back on his feet after that road accident and him having a stroke.
Yeah, sure. Look, I'll make it brief because it is a long story. In 1993, I happened to be walking along one of the streets in Melbourne, and I met Frank Quillen. I hadn't seen him for about 17 years, but we had a mutual interest in boxing, and we, of course, talked about John's accident in 1991, and he was medically diagnosed, that he'd never walk or talk again. And however, with my background, which included karate, Goju karate specifically, and studies in physical education, and I was also doing psychology at the time, all of those ideas came together for me to say to Frank, look, I think I can help John. And he, of course, asked how, and I said movement was the key, and complex movement was the most important, where John thought about the movement and initiated the movement. And to Frank's credit, he telephoned Glenys, and he gave me Glenys's and John's phone number. I telephoned that night to introduce myself, and that led to me meeting with John and Glenys a couple of weeks later, and I spent nearly 3 hours with John that one Saturday. And as we were talking, at the end of 3 hours, I was exhausted from John's extraordinarily insightful and powerful irony. And during the course of some of the conversations I was having him with there, I would start laughing, and he would then say to me, why are you laughing? And I would say to him, I said, well, you just mentioned this a little while ago, and I've just got it now. And that's extraordinarily ironic. And then he would say, it took you long enough. So bang, another knockout punch thrown by the great John Famechon. And that led me to working with John from December 1993, and remembering that John hadn't walked or really talked since his accident in 1991, which, as you noted, included a stroke. And yet, 10 to 12 weeks later, John was walking and talking, and 4 weeks after that, he ran 10 metres and started to walk independently. So, in effect, that's a snapshot of what took place, Ashley.
How did it sort of all come about? Was it something that you picked up from your Goju karate, or was it a combination of your sort of work with the psychology as well as the karate?
Look, I'm of the view that the biggest impact was the fact that I had done Goju karate, not in the sense of anything unique and special associated with that. The martial arts is often seen as having some mystical powers. There's no mystical powers in the martial arts or any activity whatsoever. But what it did to me was cause me to self-reflect at the time that question was asked. And I thought, well, movement is fundamental to the universal human condition. Added to that, and when I was doing my physical education degree, I was doing a subject called play theory. And Johann Huizinger, a theorist in the field of play, said, look, what is fundamental to any child's intellectual, physical, and cognitive and emotional development is movement. And as soon as a child is born, they display reflective movement. And universally, my inclination is that the brain needs movement to develop. And if the body is not moving, the brain is not developing as much. So I just gelled those ideas together as an intuition to say, well, the only thing that can assist John in terms of how he was diagnosed from the situation that he found himself in was movement. But the movement needed to be complex, and it needed to have John do the movement in a manner that was highly complex and even convoluted to the point of confusion. But when that was taking place, I simply had the idea that neurons would be firing, even though when I started the program, actually in 1993, the concepts of brain plasticity or neuroplasticity wasn't really something that was talked about. It's only since that we've entered the 21st century that brain plasticity is talked about, and my doctoral study of my work with John has led to highlighting that the brain is highly plastic, But that doesn't mean there's anything magical in that, or there's any magical way that you utilize that understanding of brain plasticity. It's still associated to hard work. So in effect, my work with John was to involve him as much complex movement as possible. And even though he had been diagnosed at never walking and talking again, like I said, 10 to 12 weeks later, he was walking. 4 weeks after that, he was running. And then he started to walk independently, and he even got on a stationary bicycle. And I was working with John as he was pedaling a stationary bike. I was throwing punches at him. And so all of it has added to the mix of what's been achieved with John, Ashley.
It's funny that you mentioned there that movement and the brain and the connection between that, because obviously we've heard a lot lately about athletes, and it's a big subject in society about people being depressed. And one of the things that they tell you is the best thing you can do is get out there and exercise, and that will help you overcome, you know, some of that depression, because it fires off, as you say, I presume, those neurons.
It does, and as part of those neurons firing, you have what is called neurotransmissions taking place, and the two most important neurotransmissions in our feel-good factor is what is referred to as dopamine and serotonin. And if they're firing, we actually get that feel-good factor, and I just know that from my own experience. Whenever I'm active, and I practice my Goju Karate every day, I walk every day, I'm exercising in some manner every day, and the more intensely I involve myself in my movement, Ashley, is the, actually the better I feel, the better I feel. So movement is certainly key, and I have friends who are psychologists and psychiatrists, and my own studies in psychology has led me to understand that movement is very important on a wide variety of levels, and you mentioned depression. That is a key component of dealing with depression, with a view to making your, assisting you to feel better. And if you feel better about yourself, you actually have thoughts that are far more productive in relation to what you're thinking and feeling, and you don't necessarily move into thoughts of despair. Feelings of well-being put your mind in a different framework. So I'm not talking about a panacea, but yes, movement and walking and action and activity in all of its forms is very, very important when one is feeling somewhat lethargic or even in the condition of depression, Ashley.
No, I'm sure. Now, obviously, we hear a lot about people, athletes, elite athletes, having sort of elite physical performance. And we know that a lot of athletes have sports psychologists, but do you think that athletes, if we look at them, are actually utilizing the brains and getting their brain to an elite level where that could actually enhance their performance to yet another level?
Look, the whole notion of what possibilities occur in the brain is really interesting. Now, I'll give you an example in relation to elite performance. Now, Mozart is often talked about as being a standard of elite performance, and he was writing music and reading music at the age of 13. Now, his father started to teach him how to read and write music at the age of 3, and clearly Mozart had the capacity where he had the, even as a child, was inclined to work with his father. But by the time he was 13, he had 10 years of daily practice and work in writing music. So is it any wonder that he became the writer of music that he became? And there's a book called The Talent Code written by Daniel Coyle. And he talks about whether athletes are born and made. And I'm aware in terms of your background, we've all seen athletes and people with a great deal of potential, and you see them fall by the wayside and one gets frustrated, and I know I do, and you think to yourself, well, listen, you've had so much potential and yet you've fallen by the wayside. And they fall by the wayside because that small amount of genetic potential that they had has not been enhanced through the hard work that is required to achieve the elite level. You need to be working hard and consistently every day. And one of the programs that I use in my educational field in enhancing classroom behaviours is what I refer to as immersive, systematic, self-talk, sequence learning. And the brain and the neurons actually love sequence learning, where you're doing something methodically, time and time again. And what that does, hypothetically and to some degree actually, is that all the neurons start to fire, they start to line up, and then they start to recruit other neurons, only because you're doing the hard work. And these neuronal assemblies then provide an electrical mix and electrical power and an associated myelin development on the axons. And the axons are, in effect, the wires between neurons, and they wrap in myelin, which allows the brain to have electrical impulses faster. And all of that collectively achieves a result where a person has what you could refer to as elite skills, but that has only occurred because of the daily grind and daily hard work and the self-motivation and the self-passion that they've actualized in relation to what they're doing. And I'm of the view that no one better for me is more self-motivated and more passionate in achieving positive outcomes, and that would be John Famichon.
Do you think when you look at top sportsmen today that maybe there almost should be a bit more of a balance between that sort of brain side of developing that as well as the physical, and that the two would go more and more hand in hand? Because I was reading one of your thing was saying changing thinking changes behavior. And I was, yes. I was just thinking, you know, if you did that, say you've got a player that's ill-disciplined, you know, yes. if you actually manage to change his thinking, you're going to change his behavior in a sporting situation.
Well, that's actually true. That's actually true. That's tied in with the whole notion of being able to rewire the brain. And Hebb, some years ago, developed an adage called neurons that fire together, wire together. So if an athlete is ill-disciplined, there's a number of things that are happening. But first and foremost, it's a choice that athlete is making. I've written a book called Responsibility Theory, and it's based on this question. What am I responsible for, and what power do I have? And the answer to that question is this. I'm responsible for my thinking, and I've got power over my thinking. I'm responsible for my behaviour. I've got power over my behaviour. I'm responsible for my choices, and I've got power over my choices. We as human beings are sentient, self-conscious beings. We are not robots. We've got the capacity to think and think deeply. And any ill-disciplined athlete is making a positive, conscious choice to be poorly behaved. And the brain and the body is in fact connected as one unit. The brain and the body is what I refer to now as the holos. And the holos, where the brain and body is connected, and the research is very clear on that, is whereby all neurons in the brain and the body, we even have neurons in our stomach, are uniting and firing the entire universal human condition. And any athlete that is making decisions in relation to their own condition is actually making a choice in relation to the behavior that they are presenting. And there's no point in pointing the finger at a third person saying, oh, well, look, gee whiz, it was somebody else's fault that I'm now behaving like this. You have the choice. You have the capacity to make a decision right now, in the moment of now. So I'm of the view that we have this capacity to be the chooser of the direction that we want to go.
Do you think that more people, or in the future, we're going to see this mental side of sport become a lot bigger than it is now?
Look, you can't separate the mental from the physical. No amount of thinking is going to make you a better athlete. You actually have to do the work physically. Now, the psychology is another area that's associated with that, but psychology is not a magic panacea to anything either. It's a process that helps us to understand ourselves better. And if we are having concerns about our mental well-being, it's very good to go and see a psychologist. But if you want to be a good athlete, there's only one thing to do. To work hard, work hard, and work hard again. And John wrote in the book with Frank Quill, quoting Ambrose Palmer, his trainer, these rules is what required, is what is required. First, listen. Then work hard. Practice, practice, practice. Work hard, listen, practice, practice, practice. Now, those few words, in my view, encapsulates what it means to be an elite athlete. And you can choose to practice or not practice. You can choose to be disciplined or not disciplined. The choice is actually yours, but you will only be an elite athlete if you do the physical hard work that's tied in with the thinking and what you're doing.
Well, Ragnar, I could have talked to you for a lot longer, but obviously we've got a limited time. It's been absolutely fantastic catching up with you. Congratulations on everything you did with Johnny, and wonderful to catch up again.
Thank you, Ashley. And should you need to or want to or have anyone who wishes to engage in our conversation, I'm happy to be there as one of your guests again. So thank you very much for your time, Ashley. It's been a great honour.
Hi, I'm Thomas Abraham Hearn, and you are listening to Not the Foodie Show.
Got another card for Ragnar, I think.
Maybe. Thank you very much, Thomas the Hitman Hearns. Well, as we heard there, Ragnar Purje, who has a PhD in cognitive neuroscience. Now, since we had that conversation, he was saying he'd be very interested to come over and do any talks on that sporting side. And I just find it really interesting, John, that he said, if you change your thinking, you can change your behavior. And we choose to behave as a result of the way we think. And I think there's a lot of athletes that could benefit from actually working on that side of their game, and not just their game, but also away from sport, that it would actually maybe help them cope when the game finishes or the final whistle is blown.
Well, there's a lot of conversation about that at the moment in world sport, and it seems to be the next problem that, inverted commas, world sport will face is the mental dilemmas that people have when they finish their sporting careers.
Because there is an issue, and I've had this conversation with somebody very, very recently, in that if you look at that, a lot of sporting teams, elite sporting teams now have a sports psychologist. But what you have to look at, and this is something I think a lot of sporting organisations need to look at, is usually it is the coach that selects the sports psychologist. So then you have to ask, well, who does the sports psychologist have their loyalty towards? They're brought in to help the players, or are they brought in to help the coach so that they can tell the coach whether someone is in the right frame of mind to be playing or not, or whether they actually believe they're good enough to be playing or not? Or are they there for the player welfare? Now, if they're there for the player welfare, it's a really difficult one, and I don't envy the sports psychologist, because is there loyalty to the coach or is there loyalty to the player? Because if you think that the coach has employed them, they're going to probably err towards the coach because the coach employed them and that'll secure them, give them job security. If it's to the player, then sometimes they're going to have to say things to the powers that be about certain individuals that are for the good of that individual and not necessarily for the good of the team. And I just think it's a very interesting situation, and this arose because there was one team where there are a number of athletes who are going through counselling at the moment and feel that they were let down by the team that they were involved with.
Okay, this is a very interesting topic of discussion.
Should we save it for another day then?
No. I think that if you are struggling to the point where you feel you need to talk to a health professional about the situation you find yourself in, then the best thing you can do is get out of the paradigm that you are currently in to seek that advice. It's no good going to the sports psychologist who's attached to the team, because that person is operating within the world you are living within. You are far better off getting way outside of that mindset and that thought process and the paradigms and all those other sorts of words, and getting as far away from it as possible, so that because that person will have a far different view of what's going on than anybody inside that organisation, because that sports psychologist is there at the behest of the organisation to do what's best for the organisation, essentially.
I think you make a very good point, but again, it's when you're a young athlete, that's a big call.
No doubt, it is a big call. But if you've got to the point where you're going to see someone anyway, make sure it's someone who's as far away from the issues that you're actually dealing with. Because, you're such in such a closed little circuit of family type arrangement that there's very little scope for thinking outside of the bubble of what's going on in that little world. And so anything, any advice, any of that stuff that you receive will be all focused on what's going on in that little world. Now, it may be this person who's outside of the box, so to speak, turns around and says to you, you know what? This is actually damaging and harming you. You need to go away for 6 months. You need to go and sit on a beach, do some fishing, look at your navel for a while, relax, recharge, because you're completely burnt out. But you're never, ever going to hear that from a sports scientist or psychologist within that team framework and setup, because that's not what they're there to do. They're there to make sure you keep performing.
It's a really good conversation piece, though, to discuss, because
absolutely.
I agree 100% with what you're saying. But that wasn't my topic.
Let's go.
My topic is, if we look back to when rugby union turned professional, which was around after the 95 Rugby World Cup, mm-hmm. everyone was saying that it would be the death of rugby league. I'm beginning to wonder whether it's actually been the death of rugby union, because what we saw was a lot of rugby league defensive coaches came into rugby union, and we saw the defence patterns that were used in rugby union changed, and they just spread out across the pitch. But this year now, watching the Six Nations, it is head in hands time if you grew up watching lovely free flowing rugby in the 70s and the 80s, because it is just awful now. Like, you had the game Ireland against France. Okay, Ireland won it right at the death in injury time. 42 phases of play. Now, as admirable as that is, it is ridiculous. It shouldn't happen. But what it's showing is that once you have possession now, it is incredibly difficult as an opposition team to get possession off your opponents unless they make a mistake. Because the ball comes out of the ruck. The scrum half, it's not in play until the scrum half actually picks it up. It's sitting there. It's available. Why can't the opposition play it? We also see now when players are tackled, the tackler has to release them. It used to be, you tackled a man and you tackled him and he's facing your side. That was your advantage, because the chances were your players would come over the top, ruck it out, and the ball was yours. Now the player that's tackled is allowed to turn on the ground and make it available to his side. There is no advantage. It was a skill to tackle a player and not allow him to turn the ball back to his own side in a ruck situation. So now that skill has been taken away. And also just coming in and driving over the ball, you know, at those loose ball situations has kind of been eliminated as well. So we just see people just leaning over the ball until it makes available. Everyone fans out across, then they take it a hit and drive to just draw more players in. And I just think they're absolutely, here is a prime example of where administrators have killed a beautiful game and made it incredibly dull and incredibly lopsided. And I think, if anything, everyone said it was rugby union was going to make rugby league extinct. I think that rugby union is becoming rugby league. The only difference is that it has scrums and it has lineouts.
Yeah, apart, two extra blokes in the field.
Yeah, and the points are scoring. But it's getting such a sort of version of rugby league. It's very, very sad.
I don't know why people would have thought that a sport that survived as amateur for over 100 years could suddenly throw buckets of money at itself and be a success. Rugby league has had 100 odd years of professionalism, and all of the issues they had to face through the years, they'd fine-tuned a system. Now, they still tweak with it occasionally, but the professional rugby players' system and payment, they'd worked that out a long time ago. They'd worked out all of the compromises that need to be made. Rugby union just thought, oh, well, you pay players and you're professional, and everything's all right, and we could just carry on. Oh, can I have another, you know, port, please? And where's my smoking jacket?
It's only the backs that have those.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Forwards are more a pint and a packet of crisps.
Okay. I don't reckon there'd be many pints or packet of crisps going around at St. Leonard's or International Rugby Port headquarters, would there?
Don't think so.
No, it'd be a lot of smoking jackets happening there. Now, the point being that, you know, they the administrators in rugby union were never ready for it, never foresaw that there would be issues, thought it was all going to go and happen for them. No better exemplified than Australian rugby union after the last time they held the World Cup, when they thought, oh, you know, everything's going to be rosy here. We've got a pocket of money. Kids are going to flock to us. We'll just sit back and enjoy the show, shall we? And that's the point where Australian rugby lost the plot and why it ends up where it is now.
Yeah, look, I just think it's very, very sad for rugby. And just wrapping up, really, this thing on rugby union, I've got to give a big raspberry to Fox Sports for, in their adverts promoting Super Rugby, to have the Force featured. Talk about a knee to the groin. I mean, that was just despicable.
Yeah, yeah. Hey, just before we go, you going to the Aslan Shah Cup, are you?
I am indeed.
You'll be broadcasting?
I am indeed.
On Fox?
It will be on Fox.
Oh,
yes.
Good. So there is some hockey available, hockey people. It'll be coming up. Should be a gripping tournament, too.
Yeah, I think the first day is a delayed telecast, but then most of the days there will be live games. So I think Hockey Australia put it up on their website,
yeah,
which days they are now, so if people are interested in that. And I just want to say, great thing as well, the Matildas are coming to town and going to be playing over here in Perth, and that is a great news. On Monday the 26th of March, they're taking on Thailand at NIB Stadium. Let's make sure we get down there, support them, because it's the first time they've played in WA. Sam Kerr will hopefully be playing, but also Lisa Devana.
Yep.
Sam Kerr seems to have taken a lot of the sting away from Lisa in recent, or the limelight away from Lisa, but Lisa Devana, in my book, is one of, we were talking about female athletes, there
she's
is one
jet.
Of the greatest all-time athletes there is. Now, you talk about Tim Cahill having scored in three World Cups. Lisa Devana scored in three World Cups, and I can tell you, there's not many women have done that. So, again, a really special achievement from a player from WA. And Lydia Williams, who is the goalkeeper, also comes from Katanning. She's a WA girl, born and bred. So there's a few WA products in there, and it would be great to see a full stadium at NIB. And if we can't get the Socceroos here, let's make sure we get the Matildas.
And good to see some girls out on the sporting field who can actually kick.
Some people are on the pitch, they think it's all over.
See ya. We'll be back next week.